I thank everybody for coming who's here. We have a nice showing, and I thank Torah in Motion and all their tech staff for getting us to work tonight. And I have to apologize because tonight we're going to be talking about something which I said last week we'll be talking about in 2 weeks, which is in fact true. We will be, and that's the arguments or the proofs for the existence of God. And I said we talk about it in 2 weeks, and when I started looking at all the material we have, I decided that it would probably be best to break it up into 2 weeks. We might even go to three because there's just so much to talk about. But certainly, if we start this week, we'll continue to next week. I think we just lost some of our handouts, at least momentarily. That is not good. So while I allow tech support to work that out, let me talk you through. Oh, here we go. Okay, we're back up. Okay, so we're on slide one right now, which is just the title, Arguments for God's Existence. And we're going to be discussing that tonight. Again, the topic of this whole series of classes is recent books. So how do I fit this into recent books? Very simply, there are quite a few recent books that talk about it. The most recent one that I have or that we'll be discussing is by Terry Eagleton. It was published earlier this year at Yale University Press. It's called Reason, Faith, and Revolution. And there's a class, that's actually a Christian book, and a lot of what we're going to be discussing is from the Christian perspective, and I'll explain to you why in a minute. That should be relevant to us who are Jews, but we will be. And the second book we're going to be discussing is Permission to Believe, which is not recent at all. It's almost 20 years old. It was published in 1990 by Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman, Leib Kellerman. And the third book is in between there. It's called God, Reason, and Theistic Proofs by Stephen Davis. He's a Christian professor. And really, the way I have this structured is that we're just going to be discussing the issues and pulling from some of these recent books in general as appropriate. Now, the question, the first question to ask is why are we even bothering discussing this? And in some ways, it's actually quite offensive, because all of us who are religious Jews, who deal with God on a not only daily basis, but we relate to God throughout the day, and all the commandments that we fulfill, all the mitzvot, all the prayers and the blessings, and just our random thoughts. It says at the very beginning of Shulchan Aruch that we should be thinking of God all the time. Shivisi Hashem l'negdi sami. The Rama adds that in the very first paragraph. Very first chapter of Shulchan Aruch, that this should be in our mind. We should be thinking of God all day. So to even think about or talk about whether God exists or not, the question is a little offensive to some degree, because we take it for granted and we live with it. It's part of our lives and our very beings. So how can we discuss it at all? So while that is true, and furthermore, with all these proofs that we're going to discuss and all these arguments back and forth, one way and the other, really very few, almost nobody changes their beliefs based on these proofs. I think I remember reading Bertrand Russell. A story about Bertrand Russell, who was a philosopher, a British philosopher in the early 20th century, early to mid-20th century. And he was an atheist. He was very anti-religious. But he writes a story about how one time when he was in university, he was walking, and one of the proofs suddenly made perfect sense to him. One of the proofs for God's existence, the philosophical proofs for God's existence, suddenly he found it very compelling and very convincing. And did he change his life based on that? No, he didn't. It was just a philosophical realization, and then he changed his mind eventually. So none of these proofs really have, very rarely, on very rare occasions, has anyone changed their lifestyle or their how they live based on that. But it's still valid to discuss it. I have three reasons listed here why. One is because it's a mitzvah. We believe that it's a mitzvah, as we'll talk about in a moment. Number two is because the literature is often misrepresented, and we're going to discuss that also in regard to the Jewish book that we're talking about, Permission to Believe. And we're also going to be talking about the large, really, reason number three, which is why it's very popular now. You actually see a lot of books coming out on the topic, and it's very much in the media. This whole discussion about the proofs for God's existence and God and this world, because there's a history flows back and forth. There are ebbs and waves in history, and there are trends. And one of the societal trends for a few decades was towards the religious right. People were becoming more religious, more to the right, more fundamentalist, more orthodox. And we're starting to see a backlash from that. It's been going on for the past 5 to 10 years. There's been a backlash with what you might call vocal atheists. So I see the handout is available for download now in the file share frame. So if anybody wants to go over there, it's all the way on the right of your screen. You can download it. So anyway, the vocal atheists have been growing in number and in voice and in influence in the society. And this is actually, I see that as a good thing. And why is it a good thing? Because in response to that, the response, at first I was scared what's going to happen, but the response was actually incredible because there's such an outpouring of religious faith in writing, in literature, and in the culture. You can hear so many people discussing their belief now who you otherwise would not hear it. And for example, one of the books we're discussing is by Terry Eagleton. Terry Eagleton is a very ultra-leftist literary critic from England who you would not really hear discuss his faith in public, except for this case, because he's responding to all these vocal atheists. And you see that a lot in the culture, and I think that's a very positive thing. That, to my surprise, the response to these vocal atheists has been loud and has been fierce, and I think that's to all of our benefit. But because it's in the culture right now, everybody's talking about it, it's valuable for us to review our perspectives on this. And now, just one minor point. In order to discuss whether God exists or not, we have to define God. Now, really, Judaism does not allow for a definition of God. Certainly, from the Maimonidean perspective, according to Rambam, you can't attribute any positive characteristics, any attributes to God. So you can't really describe God. And if you can't describe God, then how can we even have that whole discussion? And we'll just define God very simply as an eternal, all-powerful creator, keeping in mind that we can't really ascribe positive attributes to God, and we're just doing it for the purposes of the discussion, otherwise we can't even move forward in this discussion. So let's go back to the idea that discussing these ideas, these proofs for God's existence, is a mitzvah. So I put up here the Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch is important for two reasons. Number one, for our discussion, it's important to show that the proofs for God have a place in religion, but it's also important for another discussion. Let me read it out loud and translate. Lahamin, this is a mitzvah chafeh, the 25th mitzvah, which is from Parshas Yisro, is the first of the Ten Commandments. Lahamin, sheyesh lo'olam eloka, echad, shehimsi kol hanimsa. The mitzvah is, the commandment is to believe that the universe has one God who created, brought into existence everything that exists, the creator of everything. Umikocho vechevso hayakom mashehu. And everything came to be based on his power and his will. Veshehaya veshiye ladeyad. And now, if you remember back to geometry in high school, so there's two ways of to have an infinite line. One is to have a line, and one is to have a vector. A vector has a starting point, and then continues on forever. So that is infinite, but it only goes in one direction. It can go forward, starts now, and the vector going forward, or can start go backwards, starting now, going backwards. And then you have a line, which is infinite in both directions. So the Sefer HaChinuch is saying that God is infinite, Shehaya, in the past, and infinite in the future, V'shiyeh L'Adeyad. Always was, and always will be. Okay, let's move forward. V'inyan ha-ha-mana hu, and what does it mean to believe? Sheyikva b'nafsho shehamez kein. That you should establish in your heart, in your mind, in your belief, that this is true. V'shi efshar chiluf ze b'shum panim. And it cannot be contrary to this in any other way at all. God exists, and it's impossible for him not to exist. You can't even consider the possibility. V'mushala love. And if anyone would ask you about it, yashiv lakol shoel sheze yamin libo. And he will immediately answer to anybody who asks that this is what he believes. V'lo yodeh b'chiluv zeh afilu yomru lehargo. And you won't agree to the opposite of this, even if people say they will kill you. Shekol zeh machazik v'koveya ha'amanat ha'lev. Right? So, he just said that you have to answer to any question and say that God exists, and even if people tell you to say they'll kill you if you say the opposite, you can't say the opposite. So what does it matter what you say? It's what you believe, right? So then the Sefer HaChinuch says, Shekol zeh machazik v'koveya ha'amanat ha'lev. Because everything you say reflects and influences what you believe. So if you say something, it strengthens and it establishes that belief inside you. Kishemosi hadavar min hakoach elapoel. Because when you take that potential, that belief inside you, and you verbalize it, so that has an influence back onto you. Ritzonu lamar, kesher makayem bedivrei piv ma shelibo gomer. And when you say in your mouth what your heart believes, so that strengthens what is in your heart. V'im, and here we come to a crucial point. Up till now, the Sefer Chinuch is saying you have to believe it. You just have to establish this belief in your heart. Now he says, V'im yizkeh lalos bema'alos hachokma. If you merit rising up to high degrees of knowledge, of wisdom, and if in your heart you understand and your eyes see in this convincing proof, so this belief that you believed, you just took it on faith, you believed it, it is true, it is clear, and it cannot be any way possible, meaning you just proved it. Before you had a belief, and now you have proved it. So then, not only did you do the mitzvah of belief, you did it in an extra special way by proving it. So on the one hand, we see that just simple faith, just believing, is the mitzvah. That is the mitzvah, and if you as long as you believe in God, you're fulfilling the mitzvah. But if you can prove it with proofs, then you're doing the mitzvah extra better. So tonight's Hanukkah. I wish everybody a happy Afreilich and Hanukkah. And part of Hanukkah, the mitzvah, is we do mehadrin mina mehadrin. You do go beyond the simple mitzvah, having one light every night in your house. You have many lights for many people, because you go extra beyond the simple obligation. So too with if you're able to, you should go beyond that and it prove that God's existence, God does exist. Now let's discuss the Rambam for a minute. The Rambam seems to contradict himself. In the Mishnah Torah, at the very beginning, he says, we're on slide 5, Yesod ha-yesodot v'amud ha-chochmos le'da she'esham mansui rishon. Right? It's a key the most knowledge of wisdom is to know that there is a first cause, a first existent, meaning God, and that he causes everything else to exist, and everything that exists in the heavens and the earth and anything in between, lo nimsa'u ela ma'amitas himazo. Only on God. I once saw a book that paraphrases, is supposed to quote Rav Soloveitchik, but it ended up paraphrasing it a little bit. So I looked it up, I found the original source, and I looked it up, and what it says in the original is that man has no ontic independence, and whoever was paraphrasing out felt the word ontic was too complicated and just took it out and changed the meaning by that. What he meant by ontic independence is ontic meaning existential. Man cannot exist on his own. His entire everyone, everything in the universe exists more than nothing in the universe would exist. And that's the last few words we read of the Rambam, that everyone's existence depends on the truth of God's existence. So that's what he says in the Mishnah Torah. And the Sefer HaMitzvot, though, which is down below, the Rambam says, HaMitzvah HaRishona, the first mitzvah, He had Sivui Asher Sivanu Lahamin HaElokus. Right? We're commanded to believe God. V'hu Shena'amin She'esham Ila V'Siba. We should believe that there's this cause, this reason for. Hu Po'el L'chol HaNimzos. That causes everything else to exist. V'hu Omrao Yisborach, and that's what it says in the Torah, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, the first of the Ten Commandments is to believe that God exists. So there's a contradiction here, in case you missed it. In the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam says, the mitzvah is Leida, to know. But in the Sefer Mitzvos, the Rambam says, Leha'amin. So this, a lot of the commentators have different ways of understanding and explaining this contradiction. What's the obligation? Do we have to know it, meaning prove it? Or do we have to believe in it, which, as we saw for the Sefer Chinuch, who, I mean, chronologically came after the Rambam and was influenced by him, that there are two levels to the mitzvah. So what is the Rambam saying? Is he also saying there are two levels? So some people do, in fact, interpret the Rambam is saying, which is what's in the Sefer HaMitzvos, and the Mishneh Torah, the Rambam went even farther and said you had to know. Now, I think another explanation given is that of the Beis Halevi, and I'm bringing it up mainly not to interpret the Rambam, because I'll tell you a secret. The secret is that there really is no contradiction, and that what it says to say for a mitzvah is a mitzvah to believe, that's based on a mistranslation of the Arabic, which has since been corrected by Rabbi Chaim Heller in his retranslation of the Sefer HaMitzvot, and by Rav Yosef Kafach in his retranslation of the Sefer HaMitzvot from Arabic, because it was originally written in Arabic. Whoever translated it to Hebrew made a mistake when they translated it L'Ha'amin. So the truth is, any explanation of this contradiction in the Rambam is not interesting to explain what the Rambam meant, but it is interesting for a different reason, and let me get to this. The Beis Halevi, this was Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, the Soloveitchik that we know from Boston and from YU, his great-grandfather. So he differentiated between belief and knowledge as such. This is in his sermons on the Parsha, on the weekly Torah portions at the end of Parsha's bow. And when discussing a Gemara, the Gemara says you're not supposed to debate a Jewish heretic. A non-Jewish heretic, you're allowed to debate them. That's fine. But a Jewish heretic, you're not allowed to debate. So why not? So the Beis Halevi explains that there are two things involved. There's belief and there's knowledge. The knowledge that you have, the affirmer, can't take you everywhere you need to go in religion. There's still some sort of leap of faith that every Jew or every believing person really has to take, because knowledge can only take you so far. And after you get as far as the knowledge will take you, then you need to believe beyond that. And I think that's very relevant for translation issues with the Rambam. One of the books that we're talking about, Reason, Faith, and Revolution. So this is a major theme that he discusses. And the way he says it is that reason does not go all the way down. If you think of shade that you try to pull down, reason will not go all the way down to the ground. It will take you everywhere you need to go. Your reason, your... And why not? Actually, let me hold on this for one more slide, and we'll get back to this Beis Halevi and this Terry Eagleton. Let's first go to, we should really start with the Jewish books first. Let's go with Rabbi Kellerman, who also came chronologically first. So the first, and I apologize for going a little bit out of order, but I think this will help us. So in Rabbi Kellerman's introduction, he defines three types of believers or disbelievers. He has an atheist, someone who believes in God, means he's certain that God exists. Like the Sefer Chinuch says, you have to believe. You have to be absolutely certain, and if anybody asks you, you'll never say anything to the opposite, because your belief is ironclad. Even if you can't prove it, you firmly believe. The second is an atheist, who is absolutely certain, ironclad certain, that God doesn't exist. And then the third is an agnostic. He doesn't really know. He's somewhere in between. You have the ironclad on one side, the ironclad on the other side, and everyone in between is an agnostic. So then, Rabbi Kellerman says, since it's impossible to definitively disprove that God exists, because how can you disprove something's existence? You know, it's impossible. You have to have a negative proof, and there are always other possibilities. So since you can't disprove God's existence, therefore atheism is irrational. He just gets rid of atheism that way. Doesn't make sense. Because you can't prove that God doesn't exist, and therefore atheism is irrational. So now this I have problems with for two things. Number one, because belief and disbelief don't have to be absolutely certain. And this is what Terry Eagleton was saying, and to some degree the Beis Halevi was saying, that knowledge and reason can take you so far, and after that, it's really just a leap of faith. You know, for many years, certainly the early 20th century, we lived in what, you know, maybe the age of reason, where we believed in progress, and we believed that, you know, science and technology can solve all of man's problems. And it was a faith in technology, a faith in progress. But what we've learned since then is that it's not true. technology can't solve all of our problems. Progress can't solve all of our problems. And many of the new belief systems, you know, to some degree, that's what the Nazis proved to us, that progress and enlightenment and reason will not solve all of our problems. And we move beyond that to that blind faith that we had in reason. Postmodernism is something that we live with daily. Now, modernism, or in progress and reason, postmodernism is much more skeptical about that. Postmodernism believes to some degree that knowledge is biased, and that you can never know anything. Truthfully, you can never know anything completely, because any way you look at it, you will always be biased. So postmodernists basically give up on knowledge. They say there's no way to come to truth, so it must be there is no truth. We arrive at knowledge, and that's something he's basically convinced that all the critiques of reason and knowledge of postmodernism have pretty much concluded. You can never reach complete knowledge through reason. So instead of giving up on reason, which the postmodernists do, what Eagleton does is he substitutes faith, which I think is what the Beis Halevi was telling us some 100 years before, is that reason can only take you so far, and when reason fails, that's where faith comes in. And that's Eagleton's critique of postmodernism. It's telling us that instead of giving up on truth, we have to have faith in truth. So what we say, belief and disbelief need not be certain. So it'll take us very far off track, and we actually have a lot of ground to cover tonight, and it looks like we're going to be doing this certainly for another evening, if not two more evenings. Rabbi Norman Lamb once wrote an essay called Belief and Doubt, where he discusses, if someone has questions, does that mean he's a heretic? If he does not have that certainty that the Sefer HaChinuch says you need to have, that's a mitzvah, if you have some doubts, you have some questions, you read some articles, you read some books, and they raise some questions in your mind, does that mean take off your yarmulke, throw it away, you're just not a good Jew anymore? So what Rabbi Lamb does, and he tries to prove it from a Rashi and a Gemara in Shabbos, which is way off our topic, what he tries to prove is that even less than complete certainty is still considered belief. Now, if you take that to be true, then Rabbi Kellerman's entire argument against atheism falls down, because if a theist doesn't have to be 100% certain that God exists, then an atheist also doesn't have to be 100% certain that God doesn't exist, and that throws out his whole equation. Now, but beyond that, it is in fact possible to think that you have disproven God's existence. Now, I'll just bring one example, which hopefully we'll address from a religious perspective later on, if not tonight, then a different night. But the problem of evil in the universe. We see bad things happening to good people, to children, to babies, disproportionate punishment to anything that anybody could possibly have done. Some people really, really suffer in the most horrific of ways. This is something that Voltaire demonstrated in his very sarcastic and funny play. My mind just went blank. Someone jump in here. What was the name of Voltaire's play? Candide. Okay, I got it before anybody else did, so I win that contest. So his great Candide, he just showed, you know, disproportionate suffering. There's really no great answer. Can everybody hear me? I'm just getting instructions on how to. Okay, somebody did. Somebody got a Candide. Okay, I'm going to try to adjust my settings so I don't break up here. Someone jump in and tell me if I'm doing better here. So one of the things that Voltaire showed was that there's really no good way to explain disproportionate suffering and children. And so that some people could think that disproves God's existence. Now, from a religious perspective, we have answers to that. We have responses to that. How great they are, how convincing they are, well, that's a matter of debate. I think most of us, even if we can't explain it, will recognize that there's something going on, and maybe we can't understand everything that God has does in this world, but we have the faith and the recognition that there is some explanation to it. But it is possible for an atheist to believe that he has disproven God's existence. So again, that also, I think, causes problems to Rabbi Kellerman's argument that atheism is irrational. But that certainly doesn't mean that I'm advocating atheism, quite the opposite, not at all. So let's discuss a little bit some of the trends in the arguments for God's existence and the proofs. The arguments and the proofs go way back, far back to the times of the Greeks. You had some from Aristotle, and those Greek proofs really remain constant throughout history to the Middle Ages, when they were tweaked with and they were changed in various ways. There's a fabulous book by Herbert Davidson, and the name of it is, I have it written down somewhere here, or maybe I don't. Herbert Davidson is a philosopher, so he went through all the Islamic and Jewish proofs for God's existence in the medieval times. It's fabulous work, very technical, very difficult to go through, but he shows how really they stayed with the Aristotelian, the Greek proofs, and they just tweaked them a little bit in their own ways. And the literature generally discusses Thomas Aquinas, who was to some degree at the end of all this discussion, and he summarized it all and he put it all in his own words. He was reading the Jews, like the Rambam, and he was reading some of the other literature, but he's the one that people quote today. And he had his five ways to prove God's existence. And that's where everybody starts today, whether to critique it or to defend it. All the proofs today talk about five ways of Aquinas, which we will not be discussing, actually. We will be discussing the Jewish proofs, not necessarily Thomas Aquinas's. So all these proofs, they were tweaked with, and people believed them, and people debated them, until the 1700s. In the 18th century, these proofs were devastatingly critiqued by two philosophers. One was David Hume, and one was Kant. David Hume, I believe his blistering critiques were only published posthumously after he died. His friends convinced him, you publish this while you're alive, and your name will be mud, and he will be essentially kicked out of, ostracized from British society. So after he died, it was published. Kant published it in his lifetime, but it was acceptable because he ended with the argument for God's existence. He let one survive. All the rest, though, he critiqued savagely, and really for maybe 150 years, their critiques stood. People tried to argue, but not successfully. And on the beginning of the 20th century, so you were stuck. You didn't have any proofs that would work because of Hume and Kant. So some people tried to ignore them, and that isn't very successful. The existentialists took a totally different approach. And their approach was, we don't care if we can prove God or not. We live with God. We interact with God. This is the way Kierkegaard said it, and it was later quoted by many others. I wouldn't try to prove that my wife existed on our wedding night. I know she's there. So certainly I'm not going to prove that God exists. And in some way that actually echoes the Rambam, because the Rambam says, how much should you love God? You should love God just like you love a woman and you're passionately in love with her and you think about her all the time. So that's sort of echoed in Kierkegaard. And that was quoted by Ruf Soloveitchik and quoted by others. And so the existentialists of the early to mid-20th century, they took that approach. Their approach was, fine, the proofs for God are disproven, but we don't really care about it. And then Heschel, Professor Abraham J. Heschel, so he also took that approach. Who cares if we can't prove God's existence? We don't even need to. Well, once you hit the mid-20th century, there was a rebirth of the proofs for God's existence. Basically, the philosophers, mainly analytic philosophers in England and in the U.S., said, hold on, wait a second. Let's take a closer look at what Hume and Kant said and their critiques and see whether they're really that good. Because the truth is, as you go through each proofs, so many different philosophers throughout the Middle Ages tinkered with them that there are really a multitude of proofs falling under one general rubric. So as the arguments we're going to talk about, like the cosmological argument, there's no one cosmological argument. There are dozens of them. And so do all the critiques that Hume and Kant had, do they apply to all the arguments? And generally the answer was no. And if the answer was yes, so then they very carefully mapped out. One of the things about analytic philosophy that on the one hand is frustrating and extremely boring, but on the other hand is very effective, is that they're extremely methodical in their arguments. they line them up one after the other, number all the arguments, and make sure that each one flows very carefully from one to the next to the next, and in that way they can find flaws in arguments, and they can find ways around arguments. So what they did is they lined up all the critiques that Hume and Kant had of the various proofs for God's existence, and after lining them up, they were able to find certain arguments that bypassed these critiques. And they also employed a few other strategies. That we see. Let's talk for a minute about the difference between an argument and a proof. Let's use a technical term of argument. An argument, there's such a thing as called a deductive argument. And a classic deductive argument is as follows. Number one, all men are mortal. Number two, Socrates is a man. And number three, therefore, Socrates is mortal. So you have two assumptions, two givens. Number one, that all men are mortal. And number two, that Socrates is a man. And then number three, the conclusion works based on one and two. Now, there are two ways of looking at this, and really two categories or two ways to describe such an argument. One is that it's valid, and one is that it's sound. A valid argument is one that flows, goes from one and two, and then you combine them, and number three. If that flows properly, then it's considered a valid argument. But it could be totally wrong. So, for example, let's say number one was all lions fly. Number two is anything that flies has wings. So number three would be, therefore, all lions have wings. That's a valid argument. Because one and two, all lions fly, and anything that flies has wings, you combine them together, and you must lead to the conclusion that all lions have wings. But the problem is, it's not true. Lions, number one, lions don't fly. Number two, things can fly that don't have wings. You have some jetpack. I don't know, there are ways of flying without having wings. So since neither of them are true, even though the argument is valid, the technical term is that it's not sound, and it's incorrect. For an argument to be true, it has to be both valid, and it also has to be sound. Put them together, and then you have a true argument. So that is a classical argument, classical way to do it. Yeah, it has to be valid, and it has to be sound. Here's a new way they did it, to get around some of the critiques of these arguments for God's existence. Is what the analytical philosophers were saying. Okay, let's say we have a premise. Now, it's not sound because I can't prove it. I can't prove that all men are mortal. But it's reasonable. I'm willing to take it as a given. So anybody who's willing to take that as a given, so then the argument works for them. Now, it's subjective. But on the other hand, reasonable people, we're all sitting around a table. We're living in postmodern times where it's very difficult to prove anything. So all you have really is your judgment. Now, we put some arguments, some statements on the table, and we'll all decide, are we willing to take that as a given or not? And if you are willing to take it as a given, you can phrase your argument as, well, if that's true, which I'm willing to accept, then 1 plus 2 equals 3, and God exists. And that's one of the ways the philosophers nowadays have been getting around and revitalizing these proofs and these arguments for God's existence. But there's more. As we move on to slide number 3, this gets a little more technical, and the truth is I enjoy this because of my mathematical background. I'll try to simplify this. There's something called Bayesian probability or Bayesian inference, which is as follows. Let's say you have two archery targets, one on the right and one on the left, and you see an arrow hitting the target on the left. So which one was the archer aiming at? It could be he was aiming at the one on the left and he has good aim. It could be he was aiming at the one on the right and he just has really bad aim. So that's if you see only one target. It's very possible for someone to miss and to go on the wrong target. If you have one arrow that went the wrong way, that happens. Let's say you have two arrows on the left target. 3, 4, 5, 10, 100. You have 100 arrows on that target. It seems pretty clear that he's aiming at the target on the left, meaning you can't prove it. But based on the information you see, you have two possible models. Either he was aiming at the left and at the right. And based on the information, you can infer that he was probably, most likely, aiming at the one on the left. Meaning, you take a look at all the information we have, and based on the information, you can evaluate which of the different explanatory models makes the most sense? Which is more likely? And the way this is applied to arguments for God's existence, now I used to apply that to insurance. You know, you see how many losses there are, how many car accidents, and then what does that tell you about the probability in any given situation that there will be car accidents? But if you apply this to arguments for God's existence, so you see certain information in the world, and which better explains that information, that God exists or that God doesn't exist? And that's how this strategy of inference is applied to the arguments for God's existence. Now, again, it's not a proof. You can't prove it. No matter how many arrows you have on that target on the left, even if it's 1,000, even if it's 1,000,000, it could, in theory, be just some guy with really horrible, horrible aim. Very unlikely, but it's possible. But what it does is, for most of us, it can reach a level of comfort, maybe even certainty, even if it's not 100% foolproof argument. So that strategy on below, I have here the first strategy below. Given various information we know, God's existence is more likely than not, meaning God's existence will better explain the information that we have than God's non-existence. Now, the second way to do it is something pioneered by a philosopher in England named Richard Swinburne. Now, the way he looks at it, he looks at the various arguments for God's existence, and some of these arguments are not foolproof. They can't use them as a proof. They have flaws in them. But what he does is he combines them together and says, look, given that these facts and those facts and that facts and these facts, look at them all together, instead of saying that the chain is only as strong as the weakest link, put them all together and say, what best explains all the information that we're looking at? Take all the various arguments that you see, put them all together, what best explains it? And he says it's clearly, unquestionably, God's existence better explains everything than a lack of God's existence. And this is something we'll be talking about further, and really we can only get to that at the very end. After we discuss all the proofs, we can put them all together and say that even if none of them work, we still have, when you look at it all together, you still have a very convincing argument, even if it's not a proof for God's existence. Okay, so let's move on. This is an introduction that took 40 minutes. We've got 20 minutes left. Let's see if we can cover one, maybe even two arguments. So the moral argument. You won't look in any Rishonim, any medieval book, any medieval books, any ancient books, you won't see it in the Talmud, any Midrashim, an argument that we could call the moral argument, that since there is such a thing as morality, and we'll explain it more in more detail as we move forward, but since there is such a thing as morality, therefore God exists. You won't find that anywhere. It really started with Immanuel Kant. It's not clear that he actually meant it, but that's what people understood in his writing, that he, one of the big themes that he had was some universal moral imperative. And where does this universal moral imperative come from? It must be. It came from some supernatural source. And in the early to mid-20th century, so C.S. Lewis, who was a very popular writer, he was an English professor, he wrote very famous books, the whole Narnia series, he wrote a lot of things. He also wrote a lot of Christian apologetics. And he made this moral argument very forcefully, and he made it very popular. So here's how Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman formulates it in these three steps that we have here on the handout. Number one, there are certain absolute universal moral standards, such as that murder is bad. We could probably all agree to that. And number two, there are no natural sources of these standards. So he reviews the possible places. Where could this be? Did everybody get together and just agree that murder is bad? So that would never happen. So he basically concludes that there's no natural source for these standards. So therefore, they must originate in the supernatural, which means God. God implanted that in the universe. Now, he's not talking about, do we have to follow these standards? That's not what he's talking about at all. He's talking about, where does this universal morality come from? Forget about, is there an obligation to keep them or not? Right? Most of us would agree that you should keep them. Is there an absolute obligation? So we'll set that aside and say, there seems to be universal agreement on these issues, and where does that come from? So there are two problems with this argument. Number one, and just that formulation of the argument, you can formulate it in multiple ways. None of them really work. It doesn't work. So number one, it assumes that they're universal moral standards, which is a debatable assumption. A lot of people say there aren't universal moral standards. They're subjective morality, depending on the situation. Murder, okay, usually is bad, but they can come up with situations where it would be appropriate, or where certain people would disagree with that standards, and that it's that they would disagree. And how do you prove that the universal moral standards? You can't. So the way Rabbi Kelman does it is, if you accept that there are universal moral standards, and if then, then this argument flows. So as we were stating before, even though number one, assumption number one, is not proven, if you're willing to assume it, which I'm willing to assume, I don't know if everybody else is willing to assume, but if you're willing to assume it, so then you can move on to assumption number two. And the truth is that within Judaism, there is such a concept of natural law. And explaining, for example, if you just look at the Torah, why was Cain murdered Hevel and Cain was punished? Why was he punished? Where does it say that he's not allowed to murder? Where did God command him not to murder? So you might say, and there's such an idea among the sages, that Adam and Eve were commanded not to murder. But if you disagree with that, and some of the sages do disagree, so why was Cain punished for murdering Hevel? So Rav Nissim Gaon, an early, or depending on how you define medieval, but certainly a medieval sage, so he said, explained very simply, there are certain universal moralities that we're supposed to figure out on our own, and we are obligated to keep that. And that's why the generation of the flood, when they were, all their injustice that they did, they were punished for it. Why were they punished for it? Where is their commandment? You know, don't treat beggars, don't treat them poorly, don't cut off their legs or to make them fit on the bed, or whatever it is that they did. Where's their commandment? They didn't have any Torah. So he says, no, obviously, you're supposed to figure it out. There's this basic morality that every human being is capable of figuring out, and because of that, everyone is obligated to follow that. And this is something that's not 100% agreed upon within Judaism, but there's a very strong voice for that. Right before the Holocaust, in Europe, in the Yeshiva Slobodka, so the Mashkiach of that yeshiva, his name was Avram Grudzinski. He was a brother-in-law of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who many people know was from Brooklyn and the Mutamansi. He wrote, or his essays and his lectures were published in a book called Torah Savram. So he has a whole series of lectures called Torah Saseichel. Think about what that means. Torah, the law of the Seichel, of the intellect. Well, he argues this very forcefully, that whatever the intellect comes understands as being some certain basic humanity, human needs of morality, so that's obligatory. Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah, right? We know that phrase, Derech Eretz, so can be understood as basic politeness and basic interaction, the rules of interaction, that's even before Torah, is so primary. And then just as a postscript to this, I saw an article in Newsweek maybe a year ago, but let me read you a quote from it. Studies suggest that nature handed us a moral grammar that fuels our intuitive judgments of right and wrong. So they're saying that statement that studies seem to imply that there is such a universal morality that's innate in human nature. However, there's a problem, the big problem. Evolutionary morality, sociobiology. There's a whole field of biology now, of evolutionary biology, which tries to show morality as the natural consequences of evolution. That's the interaction, the morality that we have in social interaction is how we succeed. When we work together, when we don't murder each other, and when we create a society where murder is bad, then we succeed, and the societies that don't have that, they kill each other out. And you can, you know, deduce from there, they move on to other areas of interaction where morality, they say, is not. Let's move back a moment. So step number two was there are no natural sources of these standards. So they're saying, yo, there are natural sources for this standard, evolutionary morality. Now, there's no way, to my knowledge, to disprove this. What you could assume that evolution is incorrect. We talked about that a little last week. That's very difficult for me to accept, that you just assume it away. Or you could assume that evolutionary morality is incorrect, sociobiology is wrong. Again, that's very difficult. How can you prove it? If you're sitting around a table and everyone will agree to that, then the steps that we had before, the 1, 2, 3, of there is universal morality, let's take that as a given. There are no natural sources of these standards, let's take it as a given that evolutionary morality doesn't work. Then, 1 plus 2 equals 3, morality must come, the universal morality must come from God. But if unless you're willing to take that as a given, then you're kind of stuck. So let me read you two quotes by, these are Christian believers who actually believe in proofs for God, but they find this to be extremely weak. So this is from Richard Swinburne, I mentioned him before. His main contribution to his field of study, of philosophy, is the arguments for God's existence, and yet he doesn't like this moral argument. Let me read this to you. As it stands, this argument is not a good argument. I am too pessimistic about the prospects to devote more time to attempting to supplement the argument by producing good arguments to support its premises. He has no faith in it, and he doesn't even think he can work with the argument. Stephen Davis, I am inclined to judge the moral argument as inconclusive. See, he's not as down on it as Richard Swinburne was, but still, they don't really buy it. Yeah, they have serious problems with it. So let me just, if anyone has any questions, now is a good time to ask them, either with your microphones or type them into the chat. In the meantime, unless I hear something, I'm going to move on to the cosmological argument, which will spill over into next week. So the cosmological argument is something that we find a lot in the Rishonim. This is a very classical Jewish argument. Actually comes from Aristotle, but the Jewish philosophers all picked up on that. And the general argument is as follows. Something must have created the universe or causes it to function. Otherwise, it wouldn't be here. And the main concept in most of these versions, like as I said before, there are multiple versions of the cosmological argument, and that's going to help us as we move forward in trying to keep this argument going beyond Hume and Kant. But most of the arguments work on this concept of the infinite regress. And that's that something that exists cannot trace its cause backwards in time infinitely. Because then it would have no start, and if it has no start, then it won't exist now. So here's a simple, what they call the Kalam cosmological argument. And this is very important, because someone we discussed a few weeks ago, his name is William Lane Craig, so he revived this Kalam cosmological argument that had been out of style for hundreds of years. Even the Rambam didn't like this argument. He tossed it aside. But now it has some sort of a revival and is very much discussed in the literature. So here's how, and this is the argument really that Reb Sadia Gaon and Rabbeinu Bachya Ibn Pakuda, the Chovos HaLevavos, this is the argument that they give for God's existence, or at least one of the existence. And it's as follows. It's a 1-2-3 step, and I'm simplifying here to put it into these three steps. It's really, you know, multiple chapters in their books. Okay, but something that exists could not have made itself. It has to something has to bring it into existence, just like a child. Where does a child come from? From parents. Nothing can come from nothing. It has to come from something, and it can't make itself. So then number two, an infinite regress is impossible. Okay? And that's the assumption of many of the cosmological arguments. And if that's the case, then something must have made me, and whatever made me, something must have made it, and whatever made it, something must have made it, and keep going back and back and back, something must have made it, something must have made it, something must have made it. You keep going infinitely. If you go forever, that's an infinite regress, and there's no beginning. And if there's no beginning, then I can't be sitting here myself. There must have been a beginning. And that's the conclusion. There must have been a first cause to begin the chain of creation. Something must have started it. And what was it that started it? Everybody together, God. And that's how simplifying, but that's the basics of the Kalam cosmological argument. Kalam, by the way, is, you might call it Muslim philosophy from the Middle Ages. It was the dominant philosophical approach for a long time, and Reb Sadia Gaon adopted some of its ideas, and so did the Chovos HaLevavos, Rabbeinu Bachya Ibn Pakuda, and the Rambam has a sustained critique of Kalam. He wasn't the only one. There are also some Muslim philosophers who did as well. So that's the Kalam cosmological argument. Now, one of the problems people have with it... Oh, no. So that's... over there, that was the Rambam's. We're going to go through the Rambam's four arguments probably next week. So one of the problems people have with the Kalam cosmological argument is that the assumptions are questionable. Right? Something that exists could not have made itself. That's the first assumption. Now, is that true? Can you prove it? It's very possible to think that maybe they could, maybe it could have caused itself. Maybe there is something that we do not know of, but that could conceivably cause itself to come into creation. It's really something that we can't prove or disprove. Now, particularly the Rambam, and this is in Mor Nevuchim, he basically gives up on trying to prove that the universe was created. He doesn't think it's possible. And as we'll see, the Rambam had a different approach. He had a different strategy in how to prove that God exists. But he doesn't think it can be philosophically proven against the Kalam. The Rambam essentially rejects this infinite regressive creation. Now, if that's the case, then this doesn't work at all. This whole Kalam cosmological argument does not work. And part of it was the Rambam was working with Aristotelian philosophy. But today, as everybody knows, everybody who's listening knows, we believe in, or we're taught of, the Big Bang. And what does the Big Bang tell us? That the universe did, in fact, have a beginning. So what the Rambam said he couldn't prove philosophically, and therefore he rejected this whole Kalam cosmological argument, we now, science now tells us that, hey, Rabbeinu Bachri Ben Pakuda was right. Rabbi Sadia Gaon was right. There was a beginning to the universe. Now, once we have science to tell us that, we don't have to worry about the philosophical problems of whether we can prove that the universe had a beginning or not. We don't need philosophy to teach it to us. Science teaches it to us. Now, once we have that, then we can try to revive the Kalam cosmological argument. And it's very simple, and this is something that you're all familiar with. We had a Big Bang. What caused the Big Bang? You don't have to say, well, what caused me, my parents, what caused my parents, their parents, and so on, to infinity. You don't have to go there. We have the Big Bang. What caused the Big Bang? We don't know. So the way the Kalam cosmological argument works now is basically just look at the Big Bang and say, what happened there? What caused the Big Bang? And because you have no answer, it must be God. Now, I'm not a physicist. I'm not an astrophysicist. I don't understand these arguments. But evidently, a lot of scientists don't buy that argument. And they think they could come up with some explanation, and it could be something that causes itself to exist. Right? Number one, if something that exists could not have made itself, and they're saying, maybe it could have. Maybe there was something that caused the universe to make itself. A little mind-blowing, a little mind-boggling, I don't know. To me personally, I find the whole Big Bang argument convincing. What caused the Big Bang, and what brought all that matter and that elements and all that stuff into existence? Just a simple me, physics me, I find that convincing. But I don't think I can prove it, because I just don't have the background in physics and the know-how to be able to prove that. And maybe it's just not provable, but it's an assumption I'm willing to accept. Okay, so the later medieval philosophers rejected the whole Kalam enthusiasm for proving the creation of the universe. They thought it was naive. They didn't understand philosophy. So instead they tried different approaches. Now the Rambam, he tried to take the approach in Mor Nevuchim with what he calls, what we would call, from Gemara terms, Amiman Afshach. Meaning, he can't prove that the world came into existence at a certain point. So when instead what he does is, let's argue both sides of the track. If the world came into existence at one point, then we can say what caused it to come into existence, and we have the whole Kalam approach of there must have been something that caused it. If the world did not come into existence at some point, if the universe existed forever, so then the Rambam has four other ways to prove that God exists, even if the universe existed forever. Now, this is a little surprising because, you know, we take it as a fundamental belief of faith that creation happened, creation of something from nothing. The whole universe is created something from nothing, and we really get our cue from the Rambam on that. So for him to argue the other way in the Mor Nevuchim is very confusing to many people, and you really have to take a step back to the earlier chapter where he says, I'm going to be arguing both sides of the coin, and you have to understand that he doesn't really believe that other side of the coin, that the universe existed forever, but he's using it, but he can't make his proof unless he argues both branches of the tree, because he doesn't think he can prove it. He believes it, which, again, goes back to what we started the whole class with. Do you have to prove it? You have to believe it. So the Rambam believes that the world was created, but he can't prove it. So he's willing to take that step beyond his knowledge and with that belief, just like the Beis HaLevi said. So Okay, we just came up with another proof of the Beis Halevi. So let's talk about the Rambam's four arguments for God's existence. Number one, okay, so the first argument, and this is really Aristotle's argument, and again, I put it into three steps, simplifying it. Everything that is moving must have a mover. This is Aristotelian physics. Nothing moves without, like for instance, you roll a ball, bowling ball. So the bowling ball can't be rolling unless someone rolled it down the alley. You need to have a roller of that ball. So that is not what the Rambam's talking about. The Rambam is saying totally differently. He's saying it's a matter of priority and cause. At the simultaneously, for example, think of a fire heating a pot, and the pot has a stew in it. Or better than a stew, it has a Hungarian goulash in it. So at the same time that the fire is heating the pot, and then the pot is heating the food, so it's all simultaneously. It's not someone rolled it, and then the ball keeps rolling down. It's at the same time. But what's causing it? What's causing the food to heat up? It's that fire. So everything that moves has to have simultaneously something moving it. Some spiritual cause, something. And this goes into the whole Rambam's whole philosophy, which is beyond us, and we don't really accept it anymore anyway. We don't really care about it too much, of how there are spheres moving around the world, because something has to be moving in order to cause us to move. And this goes back to Aristotle. So if everything that is moving must have a mover. So then he goes, an infinite regress is impossible. And he's not talking about chronologically, me, my parents, their parents, their parents. He's talking about now. Right now, you can't have an infinite number of things now moving everything else. At some point, you have to have the fire that's causing everything else to happen. You have to have a first mover currently that is causing all the movement that's going on. So that's the Rambam's first argument to prove that there's a first mover. And who's that first mover? It's God. So then let's go to the Rambam's second argument. It's totally different. And in this argument, he totally sidesteps the whole idea of an infinite regress. And I apologize, I think I'm getting too technical here. So let's do this actually very quickly, and it's perfect because we don't have much time anyway. Let's go through the Rambam's arguments very quickly. It's that something cannot have, if something has two attributes, and then you see that something else has one of those attributes, there must be something else that has that first attribute. So for example, you see there's something called honey vinegar. There's honey vinegar, and there's also honey, right? You can put it on your challah, there's honey. So if there's honey vinegar, and there's honey, so therefore there must be vinegar on its own. So that's the Rambam's argument. So if moving that, now applying that to what we're saying, most objects are both moved by something and move other things. But some objects do not move others. They're the final mover. They're the final stage of moving. They're the food, the stew, the Hungarian goulash that's being heated up. So if you see some things that are moved but aren't moving other things, so therefore there must be something that moves but is not moved, meaning a first mover. So again, the Rambam tries to prove that there's a first mover, and who's that first mover? That first mover is God. Let's move on to Rambam's third argument, and we're going to do this very quickly. Actually, let's not move on because the clock just turned 10 o'clock, and I just have to point out some problems with the second argument very briefly, and this is that even if you look in standard Jewish philosophical texts like the Sefer HaYikarim by Rav Yosef Albo and the Sefer Or HaShem by Rav Chasdai Kretzkes, they point out fatal flaws in this argument. And very simple. The Sefer HaYikarim. Sefer HaYikarim is a very simple book to read. It's one of the easiest philosophical books in Jewish tradition. So he points out, what are you talking about? Let's say you have something that's red and oval. So the fact that then you look at something else that's red means there has to be something that's oval and not red. And the whole argument, the whole premise of that if something has two attributes and you find something else that has one of the attributes, then there has to be something else that has the other attribute. It's just wrong. It's just factually incorrect. And therefore, this whole argument doesn't make any sense, says Rav Yosef Albo. And the Rav Chasdai Kretzkes says the same thing. It doesn't work. So let's move on. This is not very practical, not very fruitful. And we're going to stop here tonight because we can't move on. There's just too much to cover and not enough. But I just want to sum up some of what we said tonight briefly. I think some of it was more interesting than others, but I think it's important either way just to cover this ground to know, number one, that this is all very traditional. To discuss the arguments for God's existence is very traditional. The Mefarshim do that. The traditional commentators, the Rambam, the Sefer Yikarim, the Rav Chassid Kreskes, these were all leaders of the Jewish communities. These were all very important Talmidei Chachamim in history. And this they discussed. And why do they discuss it? Because we said it's a mitzvah to discuss it. Even if you don't have to prove it, even if you just believe, there's certainly room in Judaism for belief. And as we said from the Beit HaLevi, and it certainly applies very much nowadays in postmodern times, you need faith, because reason alone won't get you where you need to go. It doesn't go all the way down. You need the belief. But even with that, the proofs are important to strengthen our belief, or to at least discuss it and to correspond with our belief. And as we said, also, because of this day and age where we have so many vocal atheists, it's also valuable to see that there's reasonable, even if we can't prove that God exists, we can show that it's very reasonable, and if you accept certain assumptions, it's very reasonable to conclude that God exists. Now, we haven't gotten to any of the proofs, any of the arguments that actually are reasonable, so I apologize for that tonight. So, next week, when we start up again, we'll continue with a cosmological argument. It actually has a very good ending to it. That's an argument, unlike the moral argument, the cosmological argument has a happy ending to it, and we'll move on in Mirza Shem to other arguments that also have happy endings to it, and hopefully this will strengthen our faith, and will even help us with our knowledge as well as our faith. So if anybody has any questions, feel free. It's already after 10 o'clock, so our time's up, but I'm more than happy to stick around for a few more minutes. And again, I'll put my email up here, gil.student@gmail.com. Feel free to email me if you need handouts. For some reason, you couldn't download it, or if you have any questions. So, I thank everybody who stuck through this evening to the end. And the Mr. Shen will pick up again next week.